There are areas in the United States where people are being driven to. They don't know why they're going to these places, but they're going there. Usually they have been abducted. Usually they have been implanted. Well, let me take that back. I guarantee you that everyone who has been abducted has been implanted. And the time that I saw the information between 1970 and 1973, the official Office of Naval Intelligence figures was 1 in 40, which works out to 2.5% of the population. How did they get these figures? Very simple, ladies and gentlemen. At that time, they still had the draft. At that time, they had draft quotas from every state representing a certain percentage of the population. A certain percentage of the population of young men had to be drafted according to the percentage of the total population that lived in that state. When they came in for induction into the military service, they were given an extensive medical examination, and even at that time, ladies and gentlemen, we did have magnetic resonance imaging capability, but the military did not put it out to the civilian community as yet. This was a new technique, a new development. They found that according to the number of implants they found in the military inductees, based upon the percentage of the population of that state from which they were taken, that the number of people in the United States who had been implanted was 1 in 40. I sincerely believe that that was an underestimate, maybe a large underestimate, simply because now today most of the abductees are women, and that sampling was taken from only men. Why they're mostly women, I don't know. It has something to do, I do know, and this may not be the only reason, and that's why I say I don't know what the whole reason is. It has something to do with the attempts for them to preserve their race in an attempt to crossbreed with human beings, either as a direct attempt by implanting or impregnating the female and allowing the baby to come to the first trimester, at which point they're abducted again and the fetus is removed, or by harvesting sperm and ova from selected human beings and attempting to grow this crossbreed in the laboratory. There is tremendous evidence to support this. Now, let me digress back again to the next major step that happened, was that in 1954, when President Eisenhower became incumbent with the office, he realized that he was going to have to deal with this, and he also realized, as I realized a long time ago, you can't believe what's happening. You can't believe what the aliens tell us, whether they be good, bad, etherical, interdimensional, whatever. There is so much deception and so many lies involved with this that you have to step back and say, I'm not going to believe anything until I can prove it. And to do otherwise is to put yourself in terrible jeopardy. Believe me, terrible jeopardy. And I can cite instances where this has happened. President Eisenhower knew that he wasn't capable of determining what the truth was, but he knew that there was some pretty smart people in this country. He put together an organization called MJ-12, or Majority 12. Majority 12 was made up of 6 men from the United States government. Those 6 men were Nelson Rockefeller, who represented the president, who was the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Defense, the Director of the CIA, the Director of the FBI, and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. The balance of MJ-12 was made up of the Executive Committee of the Council on Foreign Relations. Now, it is extremely significant that you understand that the first 6 members from the government, along with President Eisenhower, were also members and longtime members of the Council on Foreign Relations. They believed in that organization. They believed in its goals, which was one world government. Now, secretly, this was known as Majority 12. It was called MJ-12 in correspondence. When they addressed correspondence to each other, they did not address it to MJ1 to MJ6. It was J1 to J6, because secretly they were known as the Jason Scholars amongst themselves. Publicly, they were known as the Committee on the Clear and Present Danger. And to my knowledge, may still be known as the Committee on the Present Danger. I remember MJ-12 as being 12 men. However, I am still in the process of remembering, and my memory is constantly being joggled and jiggled. And one of the reasons I may have remembered it as being 12 members on majority 12 is that they had to have a majority of 12 votes to carry anything into action. Thus, majority 12. Thus, Operation Majority, thus the Majority Agency for Joint Intelligence. That's where that name really came from. Which means they literally had to have the vote of every member on it, if there were really 12 members. But having to have 12 votes to carry, being named Majority 12 or MJ-12, could have just been enough to make me believe that they only had 12 members. My memory is beginning to joggle now, and I'm starting to believe that maybe there was first 6 from the government and 12 from the Executive Committee of the Council on Foreign Relations, and that there may really be 18 members on MJ-12. Whenever I believe that a correction needs to be made, first, I wasn't going to do this. But that's wrong not to do that. It's wrong to stick to your guns because you don't want to change anything. That's silly. Because, ladies and gentlemen, it doesn't make any difference if there's one member, if there's 12 members, or if there's 18 members. What makes a difference is that Majority 12 exists, MJ-12 exists. These men were all members of the Council on Foreign Relations, and they are the secret government. That's what really counts. Now, I'm telling you this tonight, there may be a discrepancy in the number of members because I haven't confirmed it yet. But I know that there were at least 12. Everything else that I've told you about them is absolutely true. But there may just possibly have been as many as 18. When President Eisenhower put this group together,
oh, thank you.
I didn't realize how thirsty I was. When he put this group together, this group, and President Eisenhower may have done this intentionally, but there's no reason to believe that he did, because there's nothing to tell us that he did. But having been a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, he may have done this intentionally. These people saw this as the opportunity that they had been looking for all of their history. It was the opportunity, finally, to control one of the major superpowers of the world behind the scenes. Because who gets knocked off when things go wrong? The person standing out in front, right? The people behind the scenes just chuckle and laugh and say, they got the wrong guy, and they put another one right up there for you to knock off. If you're even smart enough to knock somebody off, which we haven't been. The only ones that have been knocked off, they did the knocking off. Through a whole bunch of secret executive orders and NSC memos, which are in fact executive orders, they reached the habit, actually, of using NSC memos in place of presidential executive orders to prevent the government from falling should the public find out what was really going on. It was to save the presidency. What started out as a means to save the presidency resulted in a means to prevent the president from knowing the truth. Up until President Bush, President Eisenhower was the last president who knew the entire truth. And when he left office, he could see what was happening. He was a very intelligent man. He could not have been the overall commander of all Allied forces in Europe with 5 stars and then reached the office of president if he had been a dummy. He was not Dan Quayle, I can guarantee you. He knew what was happening, and he attempted to warn us when he left office. He told us, quite bluntly and in no uncertain terms, to beware of the military-industrial complex. And who is the military-industrial complex? It is the members of the Council on Foreign Relations, and since the inception of the Trilateral Commission as well. The Council on Foreign Relations and the Trilateral Commission control the board of directors, the majority of the stock, and usually the president and CEO of all the major corporations in the United States of America, including the news media, the major publishing interests, etc., etc., etc. Usually the president and CEO is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and or the Trilateral Commissions. Many of them have dual membership. The Board of Directors is always controlled. Council on Foreign Relations and Trilateral Commission members own the majority of the stock. Nelson Rockefeller and David Rockefeller and the Rockefeller Foundation and the Ford Foundation and the Carnegie Foundation, which, by the way, the Rockefeller family owns the Ford Foundation and the Carnegie Foundation, believe it or not, own the majority of the stock in the major corporations in the United States of America. They own the majority of the American-held stock of the Federal Reserve, but the majority of the stock of the Federal Reserve is owned by the European bankers. America has been sold right out from under our noses. It doesn't belong to us anymore. It belongs to a secret government, a secret worldwide government, which pulls the strings, which says, we want this to happen here, and it does. We want this to happen here, and it does, invariably. These men are playing a game of chess on a level that we have never imagined. They're playing chess with the world. And we don't know how to do that. We can't even conceive of that. So let's not be concerned with the world. Let's just be concerned with our country, because they cannot succeed with the world if they cannot succeed with the United States. And with your help, they will not. Where do the aliens fit into this? I've told you the most important incidents that have happened. Everything else is really trivial. I've told you about the abductions, the implants. I've told you about the mutilations, the body parts being found on the craft. I've told you about the agreement. I've told you that they're here. I've told you that we have their technology. Those are the important things. Whether they're at Area 51 or at Tonopah or down in Alabama doesn't make any difference. They're here. The invasion is over. It's all over. Don't look for an invasion from space. It has already occurred and is over with. So we don't have to be concerned with that. One of the things that the secret world government is going to attempt to do to get you to accept their new world order is they're going to try to scare the hell out of you with a fake, phony landing where they're going to say, oh my God, there really are ETs. It's going to be covered by the media of the world. And they're going to say, we're going to be invaded from outer space. We have to band together as humanity to save the planet. And most people are going to say, yeah, yeah, let's do it. One world. Imagine all the people. Imagine nothing worth fighting for. Imagine no religion. Imagine living only for today. These events are always fun and unpredictable. I'll tell you what, it's time. Let's take about a 5-minute break.
Came up and asked quite appropriately, who the hell are you? And I used to start all of my talks out with who I am, where I'm coming from, how I saw this information, and what my stance is on it. And I eventually reached a point, and I keep forgetting that I'm not in California anymore. I reached a point where people would say, we already know who you are, tell us what you got to say. So I stopped doing that, but now I'm in Arizona, and I realize that whereas in California I'm very well known, here I may not be as well known. I was raised in a military family. My father was an Air Force pilot. He is a retired Air Force colonel at this moment. When I was a child, I heard stories about Foo Fighters and crash discs and things not of this world and strange sights up in the sky, and saw pictures that pilots took simply because I was the son of a pilot. Not because anybody was taking the time to show me, I just happened to be there when these things were discussed and when these pictures were shown and passed around, and usually was underfoot and eventually was kicked out and exiled to the back bedroom or the backyard. Eventually, though, I grew up and left home, went into the Air Force. I was assigned to the Strategic Air Command as an aircraft and missile hydraulic technician, which means that I worked on the hydraulics and the pneumatic systems, or high-pressure air systems, of aircraft and missiles for the Strategic Air Command. I worked with B-52 bombers, KC-135, aircraft, which is the same as a 707, only it's for refueling other aircraft and carries fuel instead of passengers. I worked on B-58 bombers. I worked on Minuteman missiles.